Welcome to World Cafe Words and Music from WXBN. I'm David Dye. Our guest today, Kamasi Washington, a 34-year-old jazz saxophonist from L.A., is changing the way people think about jazz today. While working and gigging with his cohort of musicians in L.A., Kamasi has also played and toured with many artists, arranged from Snoop Dogg to Chaka Khan, and most notably played saxophone and wrote arrangements on Kendrick Lamar's 2015 album, To Pimp a Butterfly. His contribution to that album has raised his profile and brought many more ears to his sprawling three-disc album, The Epic. The album was recorded with a 32-piece orchestra and a 20-person choir. Today, he is joined by an 8-piece band of his friends from L.A. in concert on stage at World Cafe Live this past August. Before we hear this glorious music, I sit down to ask Kamasi about growing up in L.A., and I knew his father was a musician, and I asked about his mother.
My mother played music. She was a science teacher,
though. Oh, okay. Did that make you kind of a nerdy kid, or were you?
I kind of had a little dual personality. I was definitely a nerdy kid. Like, I liked science. I liked math. That was kind of my thing before music. I had an older brother that was really, really talented, and so everyone kind of thought music was going to be his thing because he was so good, so young.
Mm-hmm.
But we all played music. It was kind of like a requirement in the Washington family to play music. But as a young kid, yeah, I was really into like science and math, and like. But at the same time, I was kind of a rough kid, so I was like the nerd's defender from the bullies.
Huh, that's interesting. Well, Kay, and you're from South Central, and I guess Inglewood now, and so you got to. I mean, the hometown band is N.W.A. You had to be into them.
Oh yeah, I was way into N.W.A. and Dre and Snoop and Tupac. That was like the soundtrack to my neighborhood, for sure. You know, like Boys in the Hood was filmed like two blocks from my house.
Ah,
so that whole scene was, you know, definitely embedded into me.
And where did your total immersion and everything I've read about you? You just sort of, when you started playing music and started playing jazz, you just went all in. Where did that begin?
Well, it started when I was like, I guess the beginnings of the immersion started around 9.
Mm-hmm.
I had a cousin that gave me a Art Blakey, Lee Morgan mixtape. And that's where I really got into jazz. You know, my dad's a jazz musician, so it had been around the house, and I had been exposed to it my whole life. I hadn't really accepted it or grasped it until I was about 9 or 10 years old. And then when I was 13, my dad left the saxophone out one day, and I just picked it up and figured out how to play this song. That was like my favorite song by Wayne Shorter. But it was really when I was in high school, in ninth grade, I was in a band called the Multi School Jazz Band. I also went to a music high school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a music academy, and so at my high
school, a magnet school.
Yeah, but it was like all for music. Like, you had 7 classes, you had to take at least 3 music classes. It was like a straight up music school, wow, basically, but for high school. And there, I was like one of the serious players. Even though I'd only been playing saxophone for about a year, I was like kind of like high up there. And the Motor School Jazz Band, these kids were like on a whole nother level. And it was funny because like some of them, like Ronald Bruner and Steven Bruner, I knew them as young kids, but we hadn't seen each other like all through junior high school. So like I missed a stage in their development. All of a sudden, like, I see them again in high school, and they were like really, really good. So we played the biggest jazz festival in L.A., the Playboy Jazz Festival. And I was kind of under the impression that I didn't have any solos, because at all the rehearsals, I didn't have any solos. So I kind of like accepted the fact that I didn't have any solos. And, you know, it was like 18,000 people there. And like out of nowhere, you know, a great, great teacher and a great mentor of mine and my dad, Reggie Andrews, he gave me a solo on a song that I didn't know how to solo on. And I just didn't feel good about how I sounded. And it was like it made me like really want to. Because I loved music, and up until that point, all of my experiences in music had been positive. But I then realized that I hadn't put the time in to really be a musician. And I wanted to be a musician, and I wanted to be a good musician. And so at that point is when I really got immersed, and I was like practicing 8-9 hours a day, My mom actually thought there was something wrong with me. She called a psychologist because I was like, I didn't want to go outside and play with my friends. That's when I really immersed myself in music, and I'm still there.
Yeah, do you ever get there? Do you ever get to that point where you sound like you want to sound?
You know, it's almost like once you get to one step of the mountain, you see that there's another. It's like one branch leads to another. So the more you grow, the more you can see where you want to grow. You know, so like each time you grow, it's like you hit plateaus, and then you grow, and it's like, oh, I want to reach that. And then once you reach that, then you can't see what you want to do next until you reach where you want to be. So I don't think it ever really ends. I hope it doesn't end.
Well, it hadn't yet, that's for sure. Kamasi Washington is our guest, and we're going to go back to the stage in just a bit to hear more of the epic played live at World Cafe Live today. And those people that you met up with again, who were from your neighborhood, been part of your musical life since then, and are part of the West Coast Get Down, which is explain. It's a group, but you're all very supportive of each other. And then you went in and made these amazing month long recording sessions where you were on each other's albums.
Yeah. We've all grown up knowing each other since we were kids, and we all kind of developed at different times. You know, like I was saying, like Ronald and Steven kind of got good really early, and then I got good, and then you know we met Ryan Porter in junior high school, and Miles Mosley and Cameron Graves in high school, and so. We've all worked a lot with other people, like from Stanley Clark to Lauryn Hill, Snoop, you know, Suicidal Tendencies, like all different types of styles and genres. We've always like kind of toured along with other people, but along the way, we always made it a point to like continue to play with each other, like just our own music. And so there's a stream of connection that we all have. There's one spirit that we all have in our music, but each of us has a different style of playing, kind of completely different style of playing. And so when Flying Lotus asked me to make a record for Brainfeeder, my first thought was like, oh, I gotta record this band of musicians that I've grown up with playing like kind of my version of what we do. And as I started calling them to get them in the studio to make that record for me, I realized that they all had that same thought, like, oh, man, I need to get in the studio and record my version of our sound. So we just kind of got together and just, you know, recorded music for a whole month. We had our little music sweatshop. It was like 10 in the morning to 2 in the morning. We were just creating and, like, helping each other, like, playing, arranging, you know. It was a very, very creative, like, just super free environment. There was no, like, no one was counting minutes or dimes or pennies. It was just... We were just in there making music all day, every day. It was really special.
Well, as you went along, were you saying, okay, this is for me, this is for you, or would you in one day record music for any number of these projects?
Well, that's the thing we have one person in our group who's super organized, Miles Mosley, the bass player. So he made this huge chart, and he had like a ledger. And so he kind of he took each day and basically from 10 to 2, divided up the hours so that like each person, it wasn't like necessarily like, it was just you got to be the leader for a certain amount of time each day.
And the epic came out of that, but originally you recorded, I heard was 45 pieces.
Yeah, yeah.
And was it easy to figure out? I mean, the epic is pretty. It's three CDs, Kamasi. It's pretty long. but how did you figure out which the ones that were going to be on that were going to be?
You know, it's funny that you say that because before we went in, I had certain songs that I really thought I wanted to have on this album, and actually, not too many of them made it on.
Ah, interesting.
So what I did is like it took me a while because you know. When we were recording, we were in there so much for so long. We were doing so much that it was actually kind of hard for me to really wrap my mind around what I had, you know. So it took me a while just to even just conceptualize what I wanted anymore. It's like I lost sight of it, you know. So what I did is I just took each song, and I kind of knew in my head, like, what I wanted each song to be when I wrote it. And I just tried to find the songs that were that, because all 45 of the songs came out great.
I want to talk to you about how you arranged them on the album, too. There are three sections, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I want to go back to the stage and hear a version of one I really love called Henrietta. And Henrietta's your mom?
Henrietta is my grandmother, my
dad's grandmother.
Mom.
Okay. And tell me about her.
She was an incredible woman. She was only about 4 feet tall. She didn't have a whole lot of education or a whole lot of money, but she was a pillar, definitely from my dad's side of the family. We all leaned on her, and like, you know, she raised my dad and his two brothers all by herself and helped raise all of her grandkids, you know, and continued to help my dad and his brothers and all her grandkids to the end of her life. And, you know, it's felt like that, you know, someone who just lives their life and an honest to an honest degree in the service of others, they often get like overlooked. Songs aren't written for them because they didn't do something that's quote unquote grand. But for me, it's not always about like, you know, how much you have, what you do with what you have. And she impacted the lives of everyone around her. So, yeah, that's why I wrote a song for her.
Is she still alive?
No, she passed away.
Oh, so she didn't hear this.
She didn't. I wish she would. I know she'd have loved it, too. I wish she would have.
Well, this is Henrietta.
Washington on flute.
Can I tell you a story of a lady so meek, fought her battle alone?
Kamasi Washington on stage at World Cafe Live with Henrietta, one of the tunes from the epic, the three CD album that is just such a wonderful expression of his work over the years. And I've heard you tell a wonderful story about how you figured out how they all fit.
Yeah. So when I got to 17 songs, I was still really planning to make one album, like one disc. And so I was listening to those 17 songs, trying to figure out what I was going to put on and what I was going to take off. And I really couldn't decide. So a friend of mine, Sophia, she suggested that I, because she knew that I was going to write string and choir parts around the stuff that was going to be on the album. So she was like, well, just start writing those. And that will kind of probably, that will maybe dictate to you what the album should be. And so the first song I wrote string and choir parts to was The Change of the Guard. At that point, I had been, you know, listening to the music for months and months and months. And, like, I probably wasn't sleeping that much because I was, like, kind of worried about what I was going to put on the album and all this kind of stuff. And so, I don't know, maybe about 2 or 3 days into doing that, I had this crazy, crazy dream about this warrior that was on the top of a mountain guarding a gate. And there was a village at the bottom of the gate that of people who all they did was kind of like train to when they challenged this warrior. And it was a super vivid dream. And I don't really dream that in that detail often. So I was like blown away. I woke up and I was like, whoa, that was crazy. But like, you know, like, yeah, it's when dreams like 10 minutes later, you forget it. So the next day I had the same dream and it happened like 3 or 4 times. And then I kind of got into the dream. I was almost a distraction. Like, people were, like, getting mad at me because I was, like, instead of writing out the music that I needed to write out for these sessions, I was, like, trying to figure out and remember these dreams that I started having. And it turned into this long story that really encompassed every song that's on the album now. And all the way up to when I finished recording the strings, I was still kind of thinking that I was going to try to somehow fit this into one disc. And then once I finished that and I kind of looked back at this story, it was almost like I couldn't. One, the music felt like one thing, one solid expression. And two, I felt like if I broke the album up, I would ruin the story. Like, I couldn't ever really tell the story because it wouldn't make sense because no one would know those songs. So that's kind of why I named the album The Epic. That's how I got the sequence for the album.
I wanted to talk about the historic repetition because that's the part of the epic where the piece of music dedicated to Malcolm X is in there. And I started thinking about his life and his vision. And that was a number of years ago. and you can see a lot of historical repetition in what he wrote then.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's so relevant to today. And I mean, for me, it was like, you know, his message was so profound for me, you know, and I was still, you're talking about, you know, 25 years later, you know, it was so relevant to me. And then now it's so relevant to young kids and what's going on in the world. And, you know, I was, you know, my parents were great, but I grew up in South Central. And so there's a pressure for young African-American men to kind of fall into these social traps and like to these lives of kind of these kind of negative lives. And I found myself falling into that. And I got in a program called UGMA, and one of the first things they did was they gave us the autobiography of Malcolm X. And when I read that, it completely altered my perspective on what I was doing, on people in my neighborhood, certain people in my neighborhood. And it just kind of opened my eyes to a whole nother reality. And, you know, I'm a musician. That's kind of what I do. But music has a way of guiding people. So I was like, if I can use my music to guide them to someone who has a powerful message like Malcolm X did, that would be great. You know, so that was my whole purpose in putting that song. Because I think he has a message, you know, for all people, really. You know, it's definitely was created for the uplifting of African Americans, but it's, we're all together in a sense. And like, you know, Frederick Douglass had a quote, you know, like, the civil rights movement is a movement to save black bodies and white souls. So it's like there's a part of it that no matter who you're fighting for, we're all together. And so like it's a really general message that I think is very important to right now.
Well, there's another piece I wanted to get to because I just, I just love it. It's called Rerun. And I don't believe it's on the third portion, but it's in there. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, it's in both. It's in the second and it's in the third.
Oh, okay. So it has some historical repetition.
It does. I thought that was ironic to have because we had two cool versions of the song. I thought, like, if I'm going to do a repetition, I should repeat myself. You know, there's a power to music and dance. You know, I have an aunt, Lula Washington, who's a dancer, and this the even the notion of how music makes people move and our perception of time, that's always kind of fascinated me. And it's, you know, music and dance, they're such communal activities, and they bring people together and they make you forget all of your troubles or preconceived notions. You can see someone dancing and then you just want to dance, you know? And so, you know, I used to always really admire the rerun. I used to always want to be able to do the rerun. And so I wrote a song, and I just thought about, like, I was thinking about different people doing the rerun around the world and how, like, I wonder, like, how they feel the first time they would see rerun doing the rerun. And that's where, like, rerun comes from. And then rerun home is, like, rerun going to Africa and doing a rerun and having them see what he's doing and how they would interpret that. No, that's the vision of that song.
All right. Well, this is it. This is Rerun. That's a piece called Rerun Home from Kamasi Washington and his band on stage at World Cafe Live. And you can hear that full performance plus an 18-minute long version of A Scheme, another tune from the epic. If you go to our website at worldcafe.npr.org, we have live versions of those songs from the three-disc album, The Epic. I'm David Dye. World Cafe Words and Music from WXBN is produced at WXBN in Philadelphia. If you'd like to hear more of our World Cafe sessions and get daily cafe alerts, you can sign up at our website at worldcafe.npr.org. As always, thanks for spending your time with the World Cafe.